You're listening to Boston Strongcast, a place where we talk all things powerlifting, strength, and the occasional scientific nerd session. I'm your host, Kevin Kahn, the owner of Precision Powerlifting Systems, strength coach and competitive powerlifter in the USAPL. Thanks for tuning in, and let's get stronger together. Hey guys, this is Kevin Kahn with Boston Strongcast. We've had quite a few in a row with guests on, and I think we've covered a lot of good topics with them. I think lately we've had a lot of very interesting, thought-provoking podcasts with Michael Ray of Barbell Medicine, Jacob Sipkin. And I kind of like the direction this is going, and it's having those good conversations has made me think quite a bit about some of the ways in which we program, in which we coach, and what we understand, and more importantly, mostly what we don't understand. And I'm going to kind of go off on, I'm sure this will lead to a couple of rants in this episode, but I'm going to kind of cover pain, performance, and fatigue, and just some of my thoughts on how they're interrelated and how they affect one another. And whatnot. And I guess this could get a little long, I think, because I think there's a lot to discuss with these topics. And, you know, maybe I'll stretch this out into multiple ones at some point and really kind of get into the more nuances of each topic. But for one, let's just, you know, I was having a conversation with John Flagg, one of my newer lifters. He does a podcast with Clinical Athlete. It's a fantastic podcast. It's one you should listen to as well. And we were talking, so let's rewind. So a few weeks ago, I decided to change up the way I was doing the programs quite a bit. So originally, I was writing out the programs in percentages. So I had an Excel spreadsheet, calculated a bunch of data and stuff, and I would put, you know, sets times reps at a given percentage. But in person, I would sit there and manipulate the weights in the sets quite a bit. If it was easy, we'd go up. If it wasn't, we'd stay there. We'd cut sets at a given point in time. Sometimes we'd add sets. So, you know, we were still extremely adaptable. I wanted to see how this stuff would work before I started like changing things up. So fast forward a few months later, and the group was growing exponentially, and I didn't want all the new people getting used to the old method of doing things. Plus, it's really confusing if you've never done it before, and I'm writing these percentages, sets, and reps on a sheet, but then telling you not to follow them. So I kind of wanted to make a change sooner than later, and I was on the fence about it before because, you know, it's hard to think about you know, how people are actually going to respond to a big change too. So I made a change, and this whole time I've been thinking a lot about, and I've discussed these topics in depth, and I'll go into them more and more as we continue on and stuff. So, you know, we don't know. Jacob Sipkin said this on the podcast a few episodes ago, and I think he nailed it when he said general principles are true until you start narrowing them down for the individual. So how much volume is best for a given lifter? We don't know that answer. It is impossible for us to know. However, they know that answer. It's in there somewhere. And we got to find a way to write a program in which it gives us those answers, right? I've talked a lot about self-organizing for technique. We need to do the same thing for volumes, intensities, and whatnot. So I made a huge change to the program. So it's no longer color-coded. There's not a lot of data in there. It's basically just the information that I want to know to be able to make good coaching decisions. So if we're doing squats, it's going to say squats times reps. I don't even write sets anymore. And I give them a suggested top weight based off of their previous week's performance. Sometimes we go up, sometimes we don't. In terms of sets, they need to decide how many they need to do. So some will end up warming up, taking a lot more sets than they need to get to that top set. They hit that and then they're good to go. So with these top sets, they get 1 to 2 what I call hard sets. So RPE 8.5 or higher. I'd rather them overshoot than undershoot for these ones. So, you know, basically the intensity is going to drive the training stimulus under these conditions. And we're going to get into why I feel this is important for measuring performance. So after they take those 1 to 2 hard sets, they're not allowed to take more. They have a choice. So they can do backoffs or they don't have to. So the rules for doing backoffs that we have is the RPE has to be under an 8.5 because they can't do another hard set. So they're supposed to back way off. And in this case, it should be something where they want to, you know, work on something, build a little bit of volume, those types of things. So when they back off, the rules are we don't want to do so many sets that they're so stiff for the next training day that it hinders performance. Also, we don't want the RPEs of the back sets to creep up into another hard set. So if it's, you know, if they back off by 10% or something and, you know, first set's a 7, second one's an 8, they got to cut it there because chances are that third set's going to bring it up into another hard set. It's just not worth it. So in that case there, they probably would have taken 4 or 5 what I would have called working sets that have some value towards a training stimulus. And we kind of just kind of keep track on each training day how that tends to go. So it's completely up to them, and I help guide the process here. Now, the tricky part here is, you know, when we're talking pain, fatigue, and performance. So we all have our biases, and as a coach, we need to find the best ways to prevent those biases from affecting our decision making. So the best way to do this is to keep track of objective measures. Now, for powerlifting, I think this is a pretty easy thing to do. We just keep track of performance. So for me, it's kind of estimated 1 rep max. Now, I use a lot of variations, so these estimated 1 rep max numbers can be based off of that variation itself. I want to see performance improving week to week. Now, we'll run into these situations where we'll see a dip in performance. So you got to remember, and I've talked a lot about this, like embracing the chaos of this sport, right? So one of the things that we need to really pay attention to here is the noise. We can't allow the noise to make decisions for us. We need to understand that it's nonlinear, these things happen, and we need to proceed accordingly. So in this case here, when we see a dip in performance, it doesn't necessarily mean that we're fatigued, that they're done with the training stimulus, that we need to change things up. It literally, these things happen. So knowing that these things happen, we can make appropriate decisions. So let's say somebody's going along, they've had 2 weeks of good progress, that third week, boom, down performance day. This doesn't necessarily mean we need to change things up here, right? This is noise. This is noise we may not need to pay attention to. So we adjust the weights on that given day. And this is what I think is great, is performance takes care of fatigue. So if the lifter is fatigued in some way, shape, or form in this place here, then the weight on the bar will just be less. We see a down performance day, they take less weight, which is typically what you would do anyways, right? On a deload, you know, they wouldn't take any backoffs here. They would, you know, maybe crush their accessories or something after, but chances are performance kind of will give them that lighter day. So yeah, relative intensity might still be high. So we're still getting that training effect on that day if we decide to take a hard set. So they, you know, they have options here. If those top numbers aren't there, they can take, you know, 3 to 5 moderate weight sets, get some work in and move on. So once we make that decision on that day, you know, I kind of pay a little bit more attention to the following days and kind of see what performance does, right? And each lift may be different in these scenarios too. So maybe the next time, let's say the deadlift had a down performance day, 2 training days later, it came back a little bit, but it was still down from the projected top numbers. You know, I still, after 2 training days, I'm still not going to change it. Like, let's see what happens next week and we'll go from there. So next week comes and, you know, they hit a PR again, right? Okay, so what we saw in that previous week, it was just a down week for the deadlift. There was, you know, some noise there. It doesn't mean we ignore it. You know, you kind of look at everything as a whole. But it shouldn't change the decisions. Like, the top sets that I chose for the following week might be a little bit less than I would have if they had hit different numbers. But whatever, you know, we move on from there. Chances are, if I was a little bit conservative with that, they take the first one, it's easy, they go up anyways, and we're right back on track. So doing things this way puts a lot of I guess puts a lot of, not pressure, but puts a lot on the lifter to know exactly what they're supposed to do on each training day. And I think, you know, developing the skill of training is extremely important. I think one of the things, so, and we're going to start connecting the dots between pain performance and fatigue and stuff here. Self-efficacy is extremely important for performance and for pain and injury, right? So science shows strong support for this. So basically, how a lifter feels that they have the internal mechanisms to deal with training or to deal with pain plays maybe the largest role in both of those scenarios. So developing self-efficacy in training and developing their training skill and allowing and teaching them and guiding them to make the right decisions on a day-to-day basis based off of their understanding of the training process and how this stuff works, I feel is extremely important to not only progressing totals, but to allow them to deal with the little hiccups that come along the way. So in terms of, so let's just look at the three, right? Pain, performance, and fatigue. So we know all three of them have physical and psychological components to this. So we also know that our emotions, our perceptions, our beliefs, our cultural upbringings, all of this plays a role into both pain, injury, fatigue, performance, all of that. If we feel that, oh, volume is fatiguing, so when I do what I would consider, what I see as a high volume week, I should see a downturn in performance because I'm tired, right? So those preconceived beliefs about how fatigue affects performance can literally negatively affect performance. So what we try to do on a day-to-day basis is we go into the gym and we see what's there. We make the right decision on that training day to get the best training stimulus that we can get on that day. And it may mean taking a really light day where we're moving around because that's the right thing to do on that given day. So it's up to the lifter to be able to navigate these things, but not to allow them to negatively affect them before they even start. So I come from a sports background, and having this, you know, conversation with John yesterday, he posed a good question. When did we start becoming afraid of fatigue? Like, there's just never this comparison of powerlifting to other sports. I played other sports my entire life, and anytime there was pain, I would have a coach ask, can you go? And it was up to me to make that decision. Yes, I can. And I would get out there. And like, here's a little background on me. And this is not necessarily the way I want any of my lifters to behave. But when I was doing the MMA thing in a training day, I tore my bicep. I was being backed up. I threw a lazy punch just to kind of turn the corner. It wasn't even a lot of force, nothing. I had deformity in my bicep immediately. Felt like the sharpest forearm cramp I've ever had. So I convinced myself there was nothing more than a cramp, even though I had deformity in my bicep. The next week, I took an elbow brace and I put it on tight enough where I couldn't extend my elbow to the point where I experienced pain. So obviously with my arm bent, it didn't hurt that much. It was more just like the extending of the elbow, and I would get that pain in my forearm. So I put an elbow brace on at that elbow angle and just carried on with life for the next 9 months. I had surgery 9 months later. It's deformed forever because I didn't go to the doctor right away. But my body adapted. I was fine. It just got to the point where, you know, the doctors felt it may be better to just take care of this now than leave the tendon curled up in the muscle belly. So it's actually tied into another muscle now, but I don't have any negative effects from that. Now, that's not necessarily the smartest thing to do. Obviously, if there's deformity, there's an injury there, and I should have immediately sought out medical attention. But my point of the story is the body is extremely adaptable. Somehow I was able to, you know, continue to train through that, put the elbow brace on, did everything I was supposed to do, made the adjustments, and I carried on with life, and everything was fine. And like before medical technologies, this is kind of how the world was. You know, you fast forward to powerlifting, right? Like, I don't understand why people don't take into consideration these other sports. These other sports lift weights plus play their other sports. And they don't even think twice about what they're doing in the gym, adding into their fatigue on the playing field. And what they do in those sports is way more than what we're going to do. Yeah, we might be doing more in the gym than they're doing in the gym, but it's probably not to the extent where we need to pay such close attention to fatigue. I think a big part of the issues with a lot of the information that gets put out there with this sport is, I think Zach Cooper made this comment, I think a while ago, one of the coaches' corners, is that the majority of athletes and coaches in this sport have been in this sport for less than 5 years. And John made a good point in our conversation yesterday. He was talking about there are a lot of old school powerlifters also that just haven't caught up to modern day science, that are still just preaching those old methods. So you have this range of inexperience and lack of knowledge, and this range of a lot of experience, but just experience doing one thing that they believe is best, and what's being missed is that bigger picture of things. You know, strength sports in general, like powerlifting, is one of the safest sports you can take part in. In fact, if I had somebody deadlifting and I put them in a rehab clinic, people would be like, oh, that person is deadlifting to rehab an injury, right? Context is everything. The second we take that movement and we put it in a performance center, all of a sudden now it's like, ooh, you got to be careful with this because, you know, we could get hurt. So I think keeping this stuff in mind and understanding, you know, how other sports play into this and what they do in other sports, like, it's, that's where the majority of the research is, right? So now let's talk about the research for a little bit, because I have a problem with this too. Our research for strength and conditioning absolutely fucking sucks. So even if a coach was trying, right, a newer coach or even an older coach, it doesn't matter, if they're trying to learn more about the science of this sport, all they have to go for in like the NSCA Strength and Conditioning Journal is a bunch of EMG studies showing what muscles might be firing on a given lift. Who gives a shit? That is a very, very, very small piece of the puzzle, and it's barbaric and archaic knowledge. We should have moved beyond this point in the research by now. And you'll still look in there and there'll be newer articles about squat and vertical jump. There's enough of that out there, okay? We know, all right, if there's a strength deficit, maybe it carries over into vertical jump increases. In the gym, we cannot train specificity no matter how much any fucking coach wants to tell you that they can. We're not training specific sports skills. We're training general abilities. Strength is a general ability. In the gym, you're trying to take somebody to make them stronger. That's it. That's your fucking goal. It's not that specific. There's not that much you can do. So now we take these EMG studies, which, yeah, they're important. It's good to know like what muscles are working, but we can kind of see that anyways from looking at the person in front of us. You know, if their knees are extending, all right, the quads are probably involved. And I think what these studies do is they lead us in the wrong direction sometimes. So we have this, I'm going to use the squat. You go down, You're coming up, chest caves forward, hips shoot back. That good morning looking squat. This is just believed all over the internet to be a weak quad issue. And like, I literally had a discussion with somebody on Instagram that was speaking as if this was an absolute thing. I'm going to tell you from my experience, from fucking trying something different, that's not true. It is not a weak quad issue. I will argue that all day long. And I understand through the research and everything else, it makes sense. But from what I am actually seeing in the gym, it doesn't make sense. I have taken people with that issue and have put them in positions to correct it and everything else. Pin squats, close stance squats. We've done a lot of stuff that, yes, we could argue that, oh, they do attack the quads a little bit more. We don't fucking know that. What we do know is we're taking them, we're changing a constraint within the actual task itself and punishing the behavior of that good morning squat because they won't be able to complete the task if they do that, and they get better at it. That, and then we're assuming, because of the shitty research that there is, that that's a quad weakness issue. It's not. I've taken those same people, and instead of doing pin squats, close stance squats, or stuff that would, by our understanding, attack the quads, I stopped doing that and put them into wide stance squats, which according to the same shitty research shows us that it's not a quad issue, that it's, so the wide stance squats shows less quads, more hips. Okay, so I do this with people, and I literally have given this to people and only given them this squat variation. Nothing but wide stance squats with a bad pitching forward. And what I saw, literally after 4 weeks, improvements. 8 weeks, even more improvements. And we're PRing our comp squat. So it makes you think. We speak in these absolutes that absolutely do not exist. So because of this, this is why I lean towards a constraints-led approach. It's a dynamic system. It's a nonlinear dynamic system based off of skill acquisition alone. Because we're not just a bag of muscles, and I will argue all day long that isolated muscle movements will never carry over to your main lifts. It doesn't mean we don't do them. We do a lot of accessory work. I think their benefit, if anything, that I lean towards anyways, is their number one benefit is increasing load tolerance at joints that typically get beat up. So we do a lot of, you know, quad stuff, right? Just to attack the knee joint a little bit so that it can handle higher loads, higher volumes, let's say, right? The back, we do a ton of back work, right? A stronger back, yeah, you get, you know, more muscle mass back there to protect things, and it gets stronger. But again, it's load tolerance. Doing a lot of back work is going to build a lot of load tolerance. So hips, same thing. Like, I think these things are important. So now, you know, let's look at fatigue, right? This is based off of research that is over 100 years old that wasn't even looking at training. It was looking at insulin response, not physical training. So then we take Hans Seely's mechanical stress model and we apply it to physical training. And then, so getting back to my example before, when we see the down performance in the deadlift. So from this, what we take is, oh, we've been building volume. This lifter must be fatigued. So we see a down performance day. Maybe we need a deload or whatever, right? So we assume that is based off of fatigue. But how do we know that it's the mechanical stress leading to the fatigue that led to down performance? We don't. These things happen, and you just need to embrace the uncertainty of things and understand that these types of scenarios are going to occur. And you don't always have the answers. Yes, it literally could be fatigue. It could be that hard training day, but it also could be that hard training day mixed with poor sleep, mixed with poor high levels of stress outside of the gym. Those things can literally be a part of that down performance. We know mood can affect performance. But we also know that under those same scenarios, 2 months later, that person could hit a PR on that day. So we need to guide them in training in a way that we don't make rash decisions. We allow those objective measures to make the decisions for us so that our biases aren't making those decisions. Because most of us are going to, in those situations, those coaches that believe in that mechanical stress model are going to be biased to make a decision based off of that mechanical stress model. Sometimes they'll be right. And the changes that they make will lead to increases in performance. However, sometimes they're going to be wrong. And then they're going to run into a scenario where they're just banging their head up against the wall because they can't understand why it works one time but not the other. And then this tends to turn, in my experiences with talking with a lot of lifters, this turns into the coach blaming the lifter for doing something outside of the gym that could be negatively affecting performance. So all of these things need to be taken into account. So when we're talking pain, fatigue, performance, we don't know more than we actually know. And I'm going to tell you, from a powerlifting standpoint, the physical component of it is probably not that high. On a given training day, yes, acute fatigue sets in. Right? It's not like you can take your one rep max, your true one rep max, if you've been lifting for a while. A beginner might be able to do this. But take your true one rep max, come back 5 minutes later and hit it again. No fucking way. That just doesn't happen. There are acute fatigue measures here. But when we talk from a physical standpoint, those physical fatigue pieces, they literally recover really fast. I mean, if you go through the literature, your CNS from high intense training recovers within a day or two. It's very rarely ever stressed beyond that point. The amount of calories we expend or the amount of glycogen we're depleting within a training session? Are you fucking kidding me? We're not doing that much. We're doing a few minutes of actual work. You know, I've used this example a few times. Let's say we take a really hard triple in squats, which I actually think squats are the hardest lifts to recover from. I think psychologically for most people, they're a little more intimidating. Also, I think, and this, my guess is just due to the eccentric loading of it, but they bang you up a little bit more. You'll be more sore the next day. So I'm going to use squats, a hard triple in squats. And let's say that takes 12 seconds because you're freaking grinding out these lifts. And 12 seconds is a long set of three. That is two plays in a football game. And in a football game, they'll have an acceleration, at least one collision on each play. How is that any less work than what we're doing with a heavy triple? I will argue, and I am pretty confident in my argument, that play in football, because of the acceleration and the collision and its max effort for that 6 seconds, is more work physically and psychologically than taking a triple on that squat. But nobody would say, oh, that player was out there for two plays, they need to take a few days off to recover from that. That's just not true. So our understanding of these things is, in my opinion, it's extremely poor. Now, all of them are interrelated. We know that. Pain, performance, fatigue. And we know these things definitely play a role. Right? Like, and I'm saying that, you know, there's not a lot of physical fatigue that builds up, right? So pain in powerlifting, I'm gonna start tying this together a little bit. So pain in powerlifting. In my experiences, I have not been around many traumatic powerlifting injuries. So, you know, people, they're lifting, I heard a pop and everything hurts and they can't move. But then a few days later, they're moving a little bit better. Within 7 to 10 days, we're back to training like normal. Those types of things. And it's the gradual onset of things like my elbows hurt, my lower back, my knees, whatever. So those things do add up, but same thing. The majority, just like fatigue, the majority of what we experience with pain is not physical. There's got to be more of a psychological component to it. And this isn't saying, I'm not saying that the pain is in your head. If you're feeling elbow pain, the pain is in your fucking elbow. But there's not tissue damage. That pain is not signaling that something bad is going to happen. It doesn't mean we don't listen to it. My underlying understanding that is hopefully a little bit less wrong, but I will guarantee you it is really fucking wrong. And hopefully we learn more over the course of time. But my understanding of that pain in the elbow is maybe that is some type of residual fatigue. Right. So somehow, you know, we've been working really hard. We've been loading it up and we're experiencing this pain. There's not tissue damage. There's not traumatic injury. There's nothing. There's nobody's having Tommy John surgery from squatting. Like there's just for some reason there's pain. And we don't understand it. And fatigue, the same thing. We're seeing these down performance days, but if the nervous system is replenished and glycogen is replenished, like why after 2 or 3 days are we seeing downward performance? My guess is it's got to be more psychological than anything. Like I think, you know, at some point you have, and this, again, this is a very simplistic example that I'm using that is absolutely not right. But so you get where I'm coming from, you get this, it's hard to get psychologically amped up to do that on a day-to-day basis. That's all. And this is why I think our moods and beliefs and everything else affect this so much. It's because when everything's in line, we have that ability to narrow down that focus and really get after something. But if we're worried about outside stress or other things going on, or you know, we didn't sleep well, it's hard to muster that same internal energy to get after something in the same manner. You know, so it's more psychological, even though it's displaying as physical. That pain is physical. That the inability to lift maximal weight on a given day is physical. You are lacking that physical capability. So I think, you know, what we need to understand is we need to change those expectations and beliefs to almost, we need to go in there expecting not to know what to expect, to warm up, to do the best that we can, to not allow that outside noise to influence performance, and make decisions on a day-to-day basis that best reflect our capabilities on that given day and that allow us to get the highest training stimulus on that given day as possible. And to reiterate, this could mean going up on those hard sets because a bigger weight is there. I'm not, like, my coaching philosophy, I think, is a lot different than other people. Like, as long as I feel a lifter is physically and psychologically capable of hitting a big fucking weight on a given day, we're gonna fucking take it. Our days of taking these little small 5, 10 pounds when they're there and leaving more on the table are done, because tomorrow's performance is not guaranteed. Let's hit that bigger weight. Let's take that confidence. And what I've seen from doing this is when there is downward performance, it's still higher than it used to be previously. So let's take someone who has a 600 pound squat. Right, or even less, right? Let's take somebody who, I'm gonna use Dave here. Dave's best squat going into nationals in October was 655. It's a pretty big squat. He hit 645 on the platform that day, moved okay, things were pretty good. So after, you know, we started pushing weights, he competes April 6th. So he had doubled 675 at the beginning of March. So we knew 700 was going to be close. So we're taking singles leading up into that meet on April 6th. The single, as the top set I put, was 685 pounds, but it came with an understanding that if 700 pounds is there, we fucking hit it in the gym. Okay, so and here's what you'll see, and I've seen this from all of my lifters. So even if Dave has a down performance, right, because we know this stuff is not linear, but he had squatted 700 and that's where his max currently sits, his best meet squat being 645, right, best squat in the gym before that was 655. So we go through another block or two in the future. Let's say, you know, that 700's not there, but 680 is. that's still a big improvement in that period of time. It just allows, when there is that downward slide, when you have a higher peak and you're losing 5% on that peak strength because of the nonlinear nature of this sport, that loss of 5% because we peaked a lot and we trained a lot harder, that 5% is still higher than it was before. So we're in a good spot to hit PRs on the platform, and we know we've hit 700 in the past, and things will be great. I think that's one way that we can embrace the uncertainty and the non-linearity of actual training. In terms of managing that, right? Like, people will be like, oh my God, that's a big improvement in a short amount of time from somebody who had a pretty elite lift to begin with. And here's my thing to them. We weren't training hard enough before, because my biases on how pain and fatigue and performance and all of these aspects were being laid out in my programs. Like, I've talked about this. You can go back in earlier episodes of the podcast and you can listen back. I talked about high, low, and medium stress days and how they're important, because the high stress days improve performance, medium maintains, low helps you recover. We were not training hard enough in order to get the results that we were looking for. So that's why we're starting to see lifters with a lot of big jumps, even though they had good totals to begin with. So now that we are training harder, we're coming into these. And this is why. So before, I would be like, oh, nobody's ever hurt because I'm so good at managing volumes. No, nobody was ever getting dinged up at all, because we weren't training hard enough to actually improve performance. And and I would argue that, oh, proper load management and all of this, like, it's great. It helps decrease injury risk and increase performance. You can't have both. You absolutely cannot decrease injury risk and increase performance at the same time. Are there better methods that probably come with lower risk? Yeah, there are ones where the coach has a good understanding of how to manage training in an appropriate manner. Now, it doesn't come from anything other than that. But just, let's put it this way. If we want to improve performance more, we have started lifting heavier on a daily basis in the gym. Every day we come in with the expectation of hitting 1 to 2 hard sets. And most of the time, there's somewhere between a 9 and a 10 when we're coming in. So we have increased our exposures to heavier weights. That increase to exposure and heavier weight increases injury risk just by pure statistics alone. The more time you encounter a stimulus, the higher the chances, the higher the probability of an injury. So now we're running into the scenarios where people are feeling a little bit of pain at times, and people are seeing drops in performance at times. Okay, so let's look at the pain. So one, we have this cultural belief that pain is always bad. It's a signal that something bad is happening. I don't know where this actually came from. My guess is I think it was in the 90s. I've heard this somewhere. I wish I could remember where to quote it, but it made a lot of sense to me and it kind of stuck. But in the 90s, we started putting pain into like hospitals and stuff as a measure of triage, right? They gave you the faces on a scale of 1 to 10. What's your pain level? Right. So I think just from that scenario, and every time you go into the doctors and they ask you that, like, it's something's wrong. What's your pain level? Something's wrong. What's your pain level? I think it just got ingrained into us that pain equals something bad because of the way in which it was being utilized in those situations. That is not the case. Pain does not mean something bad. And in this sport, you know, if you want to be elite, and I would never make anybody do anything that they're not comfortable with, they need to understand, you know, where their sport falls within their life. But I have a lot of lifters who want to be the best they can possibly be in this sport. And a big chunk of that is learning to navigate and to train through these types of scenarios. So when somebody is in pain, we have a conversation about it. But if you want to be an elite lifter and performance is still up, mechanics aren't altered, it's what you're capable of training through. And in some scenarios, the lifter is just going to be like, man, I can't train through this. Well, somebody who's a world champion probably will train through that. And that's where we kind of get, in my opinion, where we get broken up into the elite and the non-elite. And then where the elite gets broken up from the elite to the ones who are going to be at the fucking top of that mountain over the others. And it's what they're capable of actually training through. And as somebody who's been elite in multiple sports, I will 100% agree with that statement from an athlete standpoint. This doesn't mean that, you know, that lifter doesn't have what it takes to do well in this sport. You know, it doesn't fucking matter. That's the coolest thing about powerlifting, is it's here for everyone. So if that lifter comes to me and they're like, man, I really can't train through this, it's fucking killing me. You know, let's say they're doing low bar squats and their elbows hurt. Well, let's try some high bar squats. You know, we'll manipulate the angles in a way that allows them to train through it, which over time builds that resiliency. You'll kind of see in the beginning from doing this, you know, that same lifter who had that elbow pain, unwilling to train through things, you alter the angles and you keep hitting the big numbers and you manage training in that way. All of a sudden, they're low bar squat and they're like, man, my fucking elbow hurts, but I'm all right. I'll be able to train through it. Like, those skills can be trained over time, which is pretty cool to see. And I think it's important from a life standpoint to poke that bear a little bit when you're in pain and to learn to deal with it. Because you know what? I think the statistics show that every 1 to 2 years on average, you'll experience some type of back pain as an adult. So I think, you know, from a life standpoint, this sport can teach you how to handle that pain and hopefully helps, maybe even if it only helps one person avoid a chronic pain scenario from that happening, I think that's extremely important. You know, but we do have to be smart with how we measure. If, you know, somebody's in a lot of pain and performance is down, we probably, you know, we probably need to make some adjustments. There's a few things that could be going on here. So, you know, maybe that person's just done with the stimulus. Maybe there's something outside of the gym that is really affecting this person, you know, because they're, you know, we can talk about general and peripheral stress factors and stuff. You know, maybe this person's just under a ton of stress outside of the gym. And right now, training, the best way for them to train would be to really pull back and, you know, allow them to kind of manage that stress or even just adapt to it and get used to it. So like I have a few lifters. I have one of them who, so Doug got a job where it requires him to actually do a lot of physical labor during the day, right? That's a new stimulus. He didn't have that before. So we need to manage training in a way that's appropriate for him to adapt to the new job conditions and to adapt to the new job conditions plus training. In that case, less hard sets is probably more appropriate. We can pull back on the frequencies quite a bit. Instead of 1 to 2 hard sets, maybe we get one hard set per lift per week and the other day we just build some volume. Remember, general principles are still true, right? So we're still getting a training stimulus. We could keep them healthy in that aspect. And we manage training on a day-to-day basis based off of how he's feeling. Like those are the important things. I think the most important aspect of coaching is the flexibility and adaptability of the coach. And I think the most important aspect of being an athlete, being the best athlete that you are capable of being, because not everybody is built to be a world champion. And there's a number of reasons why. I know a lot of people lean towards genetics, but I will argue that it's not genetics, that the Human Genome Project taught us that our genes are just as flexible and adaptable as the rest of us, but that it's a combination of a number of different factors. But it doesn't matter. You don't have to be a world champion. But if you want to get the most out of your training, to be the best athlete possible, it comes down to self-efficacy. And we know in dealing with pain, self-efficacy can be one of the most important measures. And when dealing with performance, I will tell you right now, it is the same thing. If an athlete is capable of making the best decisions possible on a day-to-day basis, getting the most out of training on a day-to-day basis, they are going to be the best version of their athletic selves as possible for that reason. So if we have an athlete that is incapable of making good training decisions on a day-to-day basis, relying solely on the coach, there's going to be days where the training just sucks and they don't get a good stimulus. So let's say that happens twice a month where they don't make good decisions training and they don't get that good training stimulus. They don't get the best training stimulus that they could have got under those conditions on a given day, twice a month. That's not even that much. I'll tell you, I have some lifters that make very poor decisions that were really working on developing this skill. That's 24 training days where they didn't yield the best training stimulus that they could have possibly got. 24. In a 4 day per week training program that is 6 weeks, even if it's 1 day a month, that's 12. That is 3 weeks. That's almost an entire month of training that was piss poor because they were incapable of making the right decisions as an athlete. So that's why I feel self-efficacy is so important from a common sense perspective. And there's science behind why it's so important as well. There was a recent meta-analysis on, I believe it was chronic low back pain, showing that self-efficacy was one of, if not the most important aspect of dealing with chronic pain scenarios. And it didn't necessarily mean that these people would get out of their chronic pain. It just meant that their chronic pain became less debilitating and they were able to navigate it and live life the way that they wanted to live life. So their quality of life measures went up because of self-efficacy. So performance, pain, self-efficacy is extremely important. Now, I believe that training in a semi-fatigued state all of the time is the best way to go. I really do. And interestingly enough, I will ask questions at times to try to guide my decisions, but I don't want to ask those questions so early that it just develops a bias within me on what I should be doing. So after a few months of training like this with everyone and just like seeing all these like this crazy progress that just goes against anything that you would even understand. Like I had a lifter who, and as a female, she has about a 400 Wilks. Literally 17 out of 19 deadlift sessions, she hit a PR. That's months. And that's her biggest lift. So months of just continual progress. That doesn't even make sense. So we, after doing this for a while, I reach out to my coach. So Jeremy Hartman, who he's been lifting a long time. He was an elite lifter at the highest of levels. So, you know, I want to make sure I'm not going to fucking kill anybody at the same time, too, because of what I'm seeing and what I'm believing. So I wanted to get somebody else's input, and where he's a coach of high level lifters and was a high level lifter himself, I felt he was a good one to ask about this. And the fact that I'm coming up with the same ideas that, so he had told me that a lot of the lifters that he was around, that's what they preached a lot, is training in semi-fatigue states all of the time. And he was saying a lot of the Soviet coaches and other IPF world team coaches talked a lot about the same things, that training in a semi-fatigue state is how they got those lifters to that level. So the fact that I'm coming up with those same ideas, you know, gave me a lot of confidence that I'm on the right path. And, you know, as long as there's not a huge drop off in performance and you know, the lifter is managing the pain and we're appropriately managing the pain together, that's the way to go. And like, you know, classic deloads are unnecessary and they don't work. And like, this is how I felt forever. I never took a classic deload with Chico. There would just be lighter days within a week itself that might have had some really hard days in there. But I never took a classic deload except the week of a meet, which is what I'm doing now with my lifters as well. You know, and this comes from a workload standpoint. If you pull back really hard, there needs to be a period of time where ramping up happens. You can't just pull back hard and then push hard right after pulling back hard. So you need to be careful with how you're managing workloads from that scenario. So for us, we push really hard until performance drops. Then we make a decision on that training day of what to do. So if we see a big drop in performance, it's just not there. Maybe we take some moderate sets and just move around a little bit, or even some lighter sets. Move around a little bit, come in the next day with zero expectations, see what happens. And we make decisions like that from a micro and macro perspective. I truly feel that we've gotten way more good training days this way. And this is why we're seeing just such large spikes in progress. And over that period of time, I have 16 people competing the weekend of April 6th and 7th. All 16 of them have PR'd all three lifts at some point within the training block. So the fact that we're seeing, and these are all different levels. So the fact that we're seeing these PRs being hit in the middle of training blocks, you know, which is going to bring me to my next point, is leading up to a meet, I used to get really specific. So we'll drop variations quite a bit. We'll become much more highly specific and we'll go from there. So the problem with doing that is when we change a stimulus, we don't know it's going to work. We could change a stimulus and then completely not have performance there on the platform. And we're changing a stimulus based off of a bias that's just not right. It just, yes, sometimes it works, but a lot of times it doesn't. And it's inaccurate enough where it should be just thrown in a dumpster somewhere. So a lot of my lifters are running variations right up through the 2 weeks before a meet. So Dave hit that 700-pound squat. We came back with a high bar wide stance single at like 550. So the load is not as psychologically daunting to him, so it's going to help him recover. It's a moderate intensity. For him, that variation's pretty hard. It moved pretty well. I didn't let him go up in a given week before. Maybe we would have added 20 pounds or so, but at that point, because we're so close to a meet, it's probably not worth it. But we're running that up right through the meet because we were getting good performance based off of the way that that block was going. The performance was still increasing. That was a huge squat PR. I mean, he had doubled 675, which is the most weight he had ever put on his back a few weeks prior. So that's a 25-pound squat PR and an already elite squat. We're going to leave it like that. We're going to keep that block as is. And then the week of, we're pulling back really fucking hard. So he'll take a heavy-ish bench, you know, maybe around an opener weight. And we're pulling, I think I gave him 405 for a squat single and 405 for a deadlift single. So something really fucking light just to move around, feel a little bit of weight. And then we'll compete the following weekend. And then a couple weeks after the meet, I think I'm going to change things up quite a bit. It'll, you know, do more like bodybuilding type stuff, take some pressure off of the comp lifts and just change some things just to be on the safe side, because at that point it doesn't matter. We can take a couple weeks to kind of heal up, let everything kind of reset, and then we can get back after it at the right time, because he's probably not going to compete again until nationals. And that, you know, that's what I'm going to do for the majority of my lifters too. You know, I have another lifter who's moving up a weight class, so he's eating more calories and stuff. Competed in January, he's competing in April, and then competing in July again. So after January, we did a 3-day per week frequency. The fourth day was just bodybuilding stuff, and he's seen progress nonstop from this frequency. So I haven't changed it. He's running this 3-day per week training, and he's got some big lifts. Has a 93, pulls 655, he squats over 500. His bench needs some work, but it's getting there. He hit a tempo squat yesterday at 535, which was his best squat that he kind of grinded out on the platform back in November. So the fact that back in January, not November, January. So it wasn't even that long ago. So, you know, these 3 days per week, he's starting to take, you know, if I wanted to run the tempo squats one more week, I could probably get an all-time PR that he just does for a tempo squat. But we're going to try to double that next week so that we'll know something else is there. And then we'll take a bigger single. But here we are, like, we're in the time under tension. If it's 303, it's going to be about the same. So that's why I would double that. So, you know, I kept 3 days per week, but in the past I would have been like, oh, it's meat prep, so we need to add volume, so the frequencies need to increase and do all this. But if things are working, we're just going to run with them so that my bias and stuff is not going to start making my decisions for me. You know, I know I started this with like a specific topic about pain, performance, and fatigue, and I think I covered it somewhat. You know, I think our understanding of things are so poor that we need to keep that in mind when we're actually making a lot of these decisions for our lifters. I think, you know, as coaches, we want to always have the answers. And when we look at a mechanical stress model of training, it's easy to have those answers. But the problem is we don't have the answers like we think we do. And it may work sometimes, it may not. But we need to embrace the uncertainty of things, use your experience, your gut, what you do know. We do need to be aware of the research that's out there, but the research, it's a broad brushstroke. That's all it is. Keep it in the back of your mind. But remember that every hypothesis is disproven at some point. And we do need to guide training in a way that, you know, the evidence doesn't necessarily dictate training, but the evidence can help guide our decision making. And we do need to keep it in mind from that perspective. I'll cover more on these topics, but, you know, pain, performance, fatigue, their mechanisms, they both have physical and psychological components to them, our emotions, beliefs, cultural upbringing, perceptions, all of those things play a role in all three of them. I think they're so interrelated, and how they affect each other is just so unknown, right? Which to me is just, it's so baffling to my brain that how can we not understand how they interact and affect one another when we know that their underlying mechanisms are so similar. But I think, you know, this is just more of me ranting on a Sunday morning about some things I've been thinking about. But I think I'm going to, you know, this hopefully is going to kickstart just some more discussions off of the three of those: pain, performance, fatigue, how they come about, how they affect each other, how we should be navigating these decisions and these discussions with the lifters regarding all of those scenarios. But for now, follow me on Instagram. It's KWCan, our team, Precision Powerlifting Systems. Stay strong, Boston.